You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, August 20th, 2013, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Well, hello, everybody.
Hi there, Evan.
Hi.
Bob, you're back this week.
Yeah.
Yeah, work has been unbelievable, and you're lucky I'm here tonight. Just saying.
I feel lucky.
We're all lucky.
Bob, you won't believe what happened on last week's show, man.
Yeah, we recorded the whole show in less than 3 hours.
Some kind of record.
You know, it didn't happen. We didn't get buried in volcanic ash.
Yay.
It's always a good week. Mm-hmm. Always a good week when you're not buried in volcanic ash.
But on August 24th, 79 AD, Mount Vesuvius erupted, pretty much obliterating three cities, the most famous of which being Pompeii. And killing some 16,000 to 20,000 people. Quite horrifically.
Oh my God, Magnum. That's terrible.
It is terrible. When you think about it, like particularly in 79 AD, when, you know, they were pretty...
Or ACE if you're European.
Yeah.
If you're not American.
They were...
Or religious.
they were bright folks. But at the same time, there were a lot of things they didn't know. For instance, they didn't know that the earthquakes they were experiencing in greater and greater frequency were leading up to this horrible disaster. They just thought, well, this sucks. The ground is moving again, which is scary enough on its own, but they had apparently gotten used to it.
But some people did flee the city. I mean, there was a little bit of reduction, like a third or something, that decided they were going to bug out.
But didn't a lot of them get killed, though, too, because of that giant gas cloud that came out and just...
I think most of them died from the material dropping down on the cities and from the lava flows. The most famous of them was Pliny the Elder. And the reason why we know so much about the volcano, in addition to the on-the-site work that's been done looking at what happened in the actual towns, there was one written report from an eyewitness. And that came courtesy of Pliny the Elder's nephew named Pliny the Younger.
Isn't it Pliny?
Weren't very clever with names.
Yeah, I thought it was Pliny.
Is it? I don't know. Pliny? I always said Pliny.
P. Linney.
I said Pliny.
I don't know.
The rapper.
But yeah, the Younger survived. The Elder did not. The Elder, who was pretty well known as a writer and a sort of historian, naturalist fellow, he sailed across the bay toward the havoc in order to rescue some people and ended up dying probably of a heart attack or a stroke once he got there and his ship couldn't get away. But the nephew stayed on the other side of the bay, watched all this happen and talked to some of the survivors from his uncle's ship and wrote some letters to a historian, and those letters ended up making it to the modern era. And that's how we know the sort of order of events of what happened with the eruptions and the smoke clouds because of the nephew's contributions to history. He is remembered in the naming of a particularly violent volcanic eruption known as a Plinian or Vesuvian eruption.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
So I think at that time, they didn't even have a word for a volcano. They didn't really
scary,
know what they were.
Angry mountain.
Yeah, so the word obviously comes from Vulcan, the Roman god of
logic.
Fire and the forge. And they the first applied by the Romans to Mount Etna, which they thought was the actual place where Vulcan lived and forged his lightning bolts.
I mean, imagine if you actually believed that a god was inside this mountain that you lived near and he was making lightning bolts. That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. You definitely want to be on his good
side.
I want
to go say hi.
Jay and Bob, do you guys remember walking through the city of Herculaneum?
I sure do.
Herculaneum was much better than Pompeii.
That was one of the other cities that was destroyed.
I was there just a year ago.
Oh, wow.
It's awesome.
Pompeii was more destroyed and incredibly looted when we went, and Herculaneum actually, you know,
much better preserved,
intact.
Yeah.
And I remember there was a bathroom. we saw the bathrooms, and they actually had a carving above the door for men, and there was, you know, men's genitalia, and then the same thing for a women's bathroom door. Like, that's how they, you know, they don't do like a girl in a skirt and a guy with
no
a pair
euphemisms
of pants.
For the
room. Right.
No, it was all right there in the out there in the open. Yeah.
Yep. So now I know why they picked Spock in the latest Star Trek movie to go into the volcano.
Sure.
Made sense.
Yeah.
Have any of you guys listened to Ken Ham's latest commercial for the Creation Museum?
I heard about it.
I listened to everything he does. Yeah. I'm on his mailing list.
Kind of unexpected.
Here's a
Facebook
quote.
Friend.
Here's a quote. In fact, we have solid proof in our hands that evolution is a lie. The Bible. You see, we can't depend solely on our reasoning ability to convince skeptics. We present the evidence and do the best we can to convince people the truth of God by always pointing them to the Bible. Wow. So there you go.
You can do that with any book.
Yeah, you don't need reasoning or evidence or science to know, you know, what the origin of life on the earth is. You just need the Bible. That's the all the proof that they need.
Yeah, you want some proof Harry Potter existed? Allow me to enter into evidence exhibit A, Harry Potter. Yeah. And the
Deuteronomy 14:38. Okay, it's right there.
He warns his listeners against relying upon the scientific evidence. He says, you know, many of us would love to have the final proof that evolution's a lie. The right scientific proof will silence those opposed to biblical creation forever, right? Well, no. You see, Romans chapter 1 tells us that God has revealed himself to man in nature, so there's no excuse for denying witness of creation.
Is he essentially saying, when we boil it down, that this is not science, what he and the Creationist Museum and his kind are doing?
Yes. Well, he is saying that, although, you know, at other times he'll say, oh, the science proves evolution isn't true, but we don't need that pesky science because the Bible tells us what's true. And so it's kind of like a kettle defense. It's a typical denialist kind of strategy, is you could never really pin them down to one coherent position. They'll take whatever position at that time will deny, you know, the scientific conclusion that they don't want to believe in.
Yeah.
So today, Ken Ham is saying we don't need, you know, evidence, logic, critical thinking. We just need the Bible. That's
we don't need no stinking evidence.
In another page on his Answers in Genesis website, I found this tidbit. He writes, in this fallen world, the battle being fought is one of authority. Will we look to God's word for answers, or will we look to man and his changing fallible opinions as the highest authority? Nothing better exemplifies the battle than the debate over our origins. In his newest film, Evolution versus God, Ray Comfort, founder and president of Living Waters, brings to light the way evolutionary ideas are manifestations of a deeper problem. So this is, I think, a window into this, their whole worldview. It's all about authority. Which authority are you going to listen to? God's authority? Or fallible men, you know, just the opinions of men. That's what it comes down to. There is really no place in their worldview for things like scientific evidence.
Yeah.
It just doesn't factor in. It's an afterthought. You know, if the evidence contradicts God's authority, well, then it's from Satan. You know, what other option is there?
Well, who are you going to believe, God or the people that brought you the McRib sandwich?
Well, Eve was made from the McRib sandwich.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, like that's that. Right.
Yeah. Let's take him at his word then. Therefore, there's no need to try to influence school boards to try to get creationism in any manifestation you want to try to package it in into the classroom.
Right? See, then they'll,
or at
then
least
they'll,
into the science classroom.
They'll go back to saying, yeah, but there are scientific problems with evolution. We just want to question scientific authority. Why don't you want the debate? You know, they just revert back to that. So
teach the controversy.
Yeah. And then they'll go back to, well, it's a Christian nation. And so what's wrong with having Christian ideas taught in a public schoolroom, you know, which is also not true. We're a secular nation. It's right there in the Constitution. Yes. I mean, you can't win. It's not like you can actually use their own logic against them because it's not about logic or reason or critical thinking, is it? It's just about, they start and end with the authority of the Bible. So they're taking as a given the assumption that the Bible is the literal word of God, that it has survived whatever translations in history over the last couple thousand years in its current form. It's an accurate, unerring, literally true document. That's their starting point. Well, and that is their core tenet of faith. And then everything else flows from
Steve,
that.
Steve, do you see this as a move of desperation? Kind of like a realization that, well, science isn't going to convert anybody, so let's just let's just make this our default position? Or how do you interpret this kind of unexpected behavior?
Yeah, well, again, I don't think it's that unexpected. I do think that you could interpret it that way, that the emphasizing this, the authority of the Bible, is a sign that he understands that he's not going to win the argument in the arena of science. Doesn't mean I don't think they're giving that up. I don't think they're ceding that ground, but they are sort of they're not going to admit it. But I think from a practical point of view, you know, if they're shifting their emphasis towards, well, you know, whatever the science says, we believe in the Bible, you know, that is sort of, you know, giving up that front. And I think it shows that creationists are not monolithic, right? That there are different.
Oh, yeah.
You know, factions within the creation, within the big tent of creationism. I'm sure the ID guys, the intelligent design people who are desperately trying to say that intelligent design is science, don't like this kind of rhetoric because this undercuts them. Yeah, if you're trying to say this is, you know, intelligent design is legitimate science that should be taught in science classroom and it's not religion and therefore not excluded by the separation of church and state, somebody like Ken Ham saying it all goes back to the authority of the Bible, that's the kiss of death.
Yeah.
You know, that is the absolute kiss of death for that strategy.
And this is why, you know, having skeptics in place that are willing to argue against these quote unquote, you know, new discoveries, or, you know, Ken Ham coming out with a big press release about, oh, it's the answer to this question is the Bible. You know, okay, first of all, that isn't new. They're just regurgitating an argument they came up with 20 years ago. But skeptics still need to be there to refute these things because they're going to do it in 5 years. They're going to do it in 10 years. They're just going to keep, you know, recirculating these.
We're also the memory. I mean, we're the ones who are supposed to remember all of this. So when they try to shift their strategy and rewrite history over and over again, you know, we're there to document and remind the public, nope, this is what they've been saying, this is what they've been doing. Now they're contradicting themselves, that, you know, their historical revisionism is all a lie.
Not unlike Area 51, right, Steve?
Why would you bring that up randomly, Jay?
Because it's not random. Because we're talking about Area 51 now because there was a recent news item that came out where someone had requested through the Freedom of Information Act a documentation about Area 51. So let me ask you guys a question. What is Area 51?
Well, it's an area right between 50 and 52.
That's not concise enough.
It's a military base. Oh.
It's a testing facility for top secret, you know, skunk works, you know, government projects. Yeah.
Skunk works.
It's the Nevada Test and Training Range at Groom Lake.
That's right. It's a 23-by-25-mile area of restricted airspace, which allows the government, or has allowed the government for a very long time, to create military aircraft, secret military aircraft. Now, some of the military aircraft they've created their test flights and developed technology into are the U-2, the SR-71 Blackbird. Those two are high-altitude spy planes. We developed our stealth technology there. So the B-2 stealth bomber and the F-117 stealth fighter were developed there. And I think there are actually a couple of new technologies that they're developing there right now. So the bottom line is that the government created this facility there because of the surroundings. They were on a dry lake bed. It was a good place to build this type of test facility because it was remote. You know, there was reasons because of temperature and whatnot that they wanted to build it there.
Lots of alien activity.
Exactly. They predicted the aliens were going to come to that specific location. So to me, it's not a big surprise that when you have a super secret base like this, the government really doesn't want any information going in and out that doesn't need to. And so why is this one, unlike so many others, the one that got, you know, the big secret thing? You know, what was the phenomenon that was going on? Well, part of it was that people were seeing a lot of the test airplanes, and some of these test airplanes look very strange. You know, a lot of these stealth fighters in particular look, you know, really strange. But I think the one that really did it was the SR-71 Blackbird. That's a pretty strange plane. It was amazingly secret. A lot of the test flights that they do only happen at night. It just grows from there. It grew from there. People saw the airplanes coming and going, didn't recognize them. You know, they thought that they were flying too high for a normal human space flight, or no, I'm sorry, just regular, you know, airplanes didn't go above 40,000 feet. And these planes were well above 40,000 feet. So you have,
and they're so high that the sound doesn't reach you for so long that you could watch the plane fly by with no noise. So yep, that makes it seem eerie. And Jay, I think it actually goes back to the U-2, not just the SR-71. when they started test flying U-2s at that base, there was a huge spike in UFO reporting.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, the government couldn't say, oh no, that's just our secret spy plane, you know.
Yeah.
Pay no attention. Yeah. Their balloons.
Yeah, you're right, Steve. Fast forward to 2005, and someone at the George Washington University of National Security Archive, a man named Jeffrey Richelson, wrote in and said, hey, I want all the information I can get on the U-2 spy plane. And they gave him a 400-page document, and it had Area 51 spelled out with its name in the document. It had never happened before. Now, this doesn't solve any problem. This doesn't solve any mysteries, because the true believers, the people that, you know, believe in the alien mythology and everything that was going on with alien visitations and having an alien spacecraft there and the bodies and the alien autopsy, all of these people, even when the government does release information, it doesn't you know, give them any moment of pause. They'll say, well, yeah, but that's their further cover-up. Okay, so we're revealing a little bit of the information, but you'll never hear about the aliens. You know, the aliens might not even be there anymore. So it'll never kill the conspiracy. But when this type of news item comes out, just like the one that we just talked about, we need skeptics there to remind people, you know, this is what the base was for, and there's no solid proof, and just go into it. People at work were actually talking about this today, and I actually, you know, decided to wait a day because I was frustrated with what they're saying. I didn't want to have too much ass in my voice. So tomorrow when I go to work, I'll revisit this topic and let them know, hey, you know, this is what it is, and there's no solid proof on anything, and all the things that you guys were talking about yesterday, it's all conjecture, and I'm being very polite.
If you believe in the conspiracy, again, it's like Ken Ham. If you believe that the Bible is the word of God and you start from there, well, then there's no evidence or logic that can dissuade you from that. If you believe that the government has the power and the motive for a massive cover-up, then nothing the government says is obviously going to dissuade you from that. You know, and if that premise were true, sure, it shouldn't. You know, so it's at least internally consistent. The problem is they're starting with that premise, and it becomes a closed belief system.
Yep.
Just like literalism, it's a closed belief system. There is no evidence that could ever dissuade you from that. Right. There is no lack of evidence that becomes a problem for your belief system.
But, you know, when this item came out, I got excited because I was hoping, you know, maybe there's something cool we'll find out. No, nothing. Not even one thing.
They just declassified the name Area 51. That's it. In previous documents, it's been redacted. Now they decided they no longer need to redact the name Area 51. That's it. It's not like any kind of full disclosure on what they've been doing.
Yeah, not at all. But I wonder why. I mean, why now? Why? You know, why aren't they redacting the name anymore? I mean, did they just say, well, what the hell? I mean, enough times, you know?
Somebody decided it was no longer a security risk to let the name out. It also reminded me a lot of, you know, when the Air Force came out and said, oh, yeah, that whole Roswell crash saucer thing, that was a secret Project Mogul where we were spying on Soviet nuclear testing. Again, it was a secret program. They had to cover it up. They couldn't say what the real explanation was. So that breeds conspiracy theories and, you know, imaginations. But while we're wasting all of our time developing, you know, high-flying space planes, the Australians are solving real problems like how to make beer even better.
Oh. I wouldn't say better.
They're trying.
Well, they're trying different things. Among them is trying to come up with a beer that will, well, lessen or eliminate the effects of a hangover. Some scientists in Australia claim to have done just that. The headline, as it reads in the Australian Times, here's how it reads. Australian scientists discover the secret to hydrating beer. Australian researchers have found a way to improve the hydrating qualities of beer without compromising on taste. Sounds like an advertisement. By adding electrolytes to the amber ale, the researchers from a Queensland university may have even found a way to avoid a post-drink hangover. The researchers from Griffith University Health Institute found that by adding electrolytes to beer, which is a common ingredient found in sports drinks, the electrolytes, that is, plus reducing the alcohol content could make a beer more refreshing than ever, as they describe it. All right, here's the crux of the study they conducted. The experiment consisted of making people who had just finished exercising, and therefore sweating a lot, they would have them drink one of four beers. There were two full-strength beers and two what are considered light beers, by contrast, a little less alcohol per se. And one of each of those types, the full-strength and the light beer, each had electrolytes added. Okay, so there were basically four beers on the table to choose from, or were given. Participants were asked to drink 150% of the amount of lost body mass due to exercise, and they had to complete their drinking session in 1 hour. The scientists determined that the best performer with respect to hydration was the electrolyte light beer. Researchers declared it was one-third more effective with respect to hydration than a normal beer, one untreated with electrolytes. The trade-off, of course, was that the light beer had less alcohol, but in each case, the scientists claimed that no one noticed any different in the taste with any of the other beers.
I am highly skeptical of that.
I was very skeptical of the whole darn thing.
I have never had a light beer that didn't taste like watered-down piss.
As opposed to the highly concentrated piss that beer normally tastes like.
Yeah, delicious piss. That I
prefer. Yeah, you're right, Rebecca. I mean, light beer... It has less alcohol in it. That's why it's light.
You know what else has electrolytes? Every bar snack. Snack in a dish on the bar that is in front of you while you're drinking your beer. So
sodium,
you could experience the same exact result by drinking a good beer and eating a few pretzels and drinking a glass of water alongside it.
Right.
I had several problems with this. That was not one of them. I don't drink beer, so I don't give a crap. But so first they have two variables that they're playing with. Of course, less alcohol is going to be less dehydrating. So the fact that it was the less, you know, electrolytes with the lower alcohol beer, that's not impressive. If it were with the, you know, also with the higher alcohol content beer, then that would at least be something. Also, the study population, people who have been exercising and sweating. Not exactly a good population. Do you tend to go to the bar and drink beer right from the gym?
No.
And they say we don't.
Where do you think I run to every day?
But this is a population that would most likely benefit from electrolyte replacement. So they're stacking the deck right there. So mixing variables, they're stacking the deck with their target population, and also I don't like the premise. You know what? Dehydration does not cause the hangover. It may make it worse. You may get dehydrated, and you know, certainly hydrating during and after drinking is a good idea, but that's not the cause of a hangover, as the article implies. The cause of a hangover is the breakdown products of alcohol. And there's no way to speed up the getting over the hangover, other than, you know, certain drugs, but you have to metabolize, you know, weigh those breakdown products. That's it. And that just takes time.
Part of what you're describing, Steve, is, of course, the headache component of the hangover, which is typically the thing that people feel the most, right? It's the most obvious thing going on. But there are other things going on during the course of the hangover, right? Trouble sleeping, sensitivity to light and sound, trouble concentrating, perhaps some diarrhea, flatulence, fatigue, and a bunch of other things. But the headache
is the key there. But that's not solely caused by dehydration. It's not.
No, it's not. In fact, no, you're exactly right. You're right. Like you said, it had to do with the acetic acid that breaks down when the alcohol is metabolized in the system. Thank goodness for the folks over at geek.com. I should have known to go there in the first place, where they were highly skeptical about this because they explained that in the experiments, the subject exercised until they lost about 2% of their body mass, then replenished most of it with beer. The sodium fortified light beer did not result in any statistically significant improvement of fluid retention compared to regular light beer. I thought that was pretty significant. And they also, of course, brought up the major component being the headache. And the acetaldehyde that is the major product of alcohol metabolism, as shown in prior studies, seems to be the primary cause of headaches when it comes to alcohol consumption.
That's why all like home remedy hangover cures don't work. You know, I think you're probably better off just telling people, just pace yourself and make sure you're drinking enough fluid and eating, you know, when you're drinking, and you'll probably be fine. All right, we do have to turn to a more serious news item. Another one of our fellow Indian rationalists has been found dead. Rebecca, are you going to tell us about this?
Yeah, this is horrible. It just happened today, as in the day we're recording this. Narendra Dabhokar, who was the founder and president of the Maharashtra Committee for the Eradication of Superstition, was found today shot dead by two men riding either a motorcycle or two motorcycles. I'm not too clear on that. Police are investigating, but they don't know who did it or what the motives were. But They identified him by his wallet that he was still carrying. So, I mean, I think that rules out robbery. They just shot him and tore away, which suggests that this was a targeted murder.
Seemed like a hit, yeah.
Yeah. Dabhokar was one of the leading advocates of an anti-superstition bill in his home state of Maharashtra. This anti-superstition bill was pretty severe, at least by American standards, but would basically prohibit acts like performing magical rites, selling talismans for the purposes of exorcism, beating mentally ill patients in the belief that they're possessed by evil spirits, and in some cases, not even allowing the performance of some religious cults like Karni and Banamati, which were like, which are quote unquote black magic cults, of the Hindu faith. And because of that, conservatives in the area and many religious sects felt targeted by the bill. Some actually were very much targeted. They called the bill anti-Hindu, and they've been holding it up for quite a long time. But a few days ago, the government announced that it planned to actually table the bill. So they had finally gained some ground, and suddenly, a murder. And as frequent listeners of the show know, this isn't the first time we've talked about problems in India that the rationalist community there has faced. We've talked about Sanal Eddamaruku, and I believe we have an interview with him coming up soon, who was driven into exile basically over death threats and also a count of blasphemy charged by the Catholic Church when he debunked a crying statue. So the rationalist community of India is very strong, very motivated, but at the same time, they're facing a huge amount of backlash. And this is a really horribly high-profile, tragic example of that. So Narendra Dabhokar, he was an awesome guy. He did a lot of great things for the community. Hopefully his murder doesn't dissuade the other rationalists from stepping up and stepping into the spotlight and continuing the work that he started. And I've heard from a few people in the community, and they seem very motivated to continue his work, which is a small sliver of good news in what is otherwise a really horrible tragedy.
Yeah. Yeah. We definitely have an uphill battle where we are, but we're not getting shot and killed or sent into exile from our own country because we're promoting
huge
skepticism.
Difference. So, and another sliver that occurred to me, Rebecca, would be that, you know, the Maharashtra government said that they were going to introduce this. And in fact, he was murdered days after they said that. Hopefully maybe, it really will be introduced and passed, and partly because of this heinous act.
I mean, and in this specific case, it may help people realize that this isn't necessarily about outlawing people's religion of choice. Mm-hmm. It's not about stopping people from believing what they want to believe. It's about putting a real serious dent in what is becoming a mafia of superstition.
Ooh, I like that. Wow.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Run by these, by these holy men.
Yeah.
That's a good way of putting it, Rebecca, because there's money on the line. There's livelihoods.
Money and power.
There's people making.
And I mean, we're talking about people who are doing jobs in which they are knowingly fleecing innocent people out of their life savings in some cases. They're promising miracle cures. You know, these people are doing all of the horrible things that we talked about on this show.
All right. Well, thanks, Rebecca. So, Bob, there's been a little bit of an update on free roaming planets. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this was pretty cool. Scientists now theorize that all the recently discovered rogue planets in our galaxy, we talked about this, I think, last year, were not necessarily ejected from a conventional solar system, as many people believe is the exclusive way that they were created. Many could have potentially formed essentially on their own far from any parent star. How weird is that? I mean, try to think. Well, how could a planet form? Well, you guys remember rogue planets, right? In the past few years, we, the SGU, specifically us, we found evidence that there must be
That was great work that, we did.
Yeah, was that we found that there must be a mind-numbing number of rogue planets in the Milky Way. They estimate over 200 billion of them. In fact, they could even outnumber conventional planets that we think of when we think of planets, ones that are, of course, tethered gravitationally to their own star. Now, it seemed obvious that they became rogues after being ejected, right, from their parent solar system. Until the solar system's planets settle down, there's probably going to be a bunch of things that get ejected, planets, planetesimals, meters, all sorts of things that get ejected as the smaller planets or whatever get closer to the bigger ones, and bam, you get the gravitational slingshot, and bam, they're out of the solar system, and there you go, you have a rogue planet.
Bam.
Yeah, bam. That's what it sounds like in space. So what's not obvious, though, is that planets could form by themselves. So, I mean, how do you guys think that that's even possible?
Well, is it just that the central collapse of the cloud does not get dense enough to form a star?
Kind of. But so researchers from the Chalmers University of Technology in Sweden, where Eric Northman comes from, by the way, these researchers analyzed radio and infrared data collected from telescopes all over the place. And their specific interest, though, was the Rosette Nebula, which is basically a huge gas cloud about 5,600 light years away. And it's in the constellation I never heard of, Monoceros, which means, anybody know what that means?
Single horn.
The
Rebecca?
Unicorn.
Oh. Ah, very good. Very nice. So they focused.
You went to me on that one. I am the unicorn expert here.
Yes.
All girls like unicorns.
Unicorns and sloths.
I do like unicorns.
But they focused on a relatively tiny, but these somewhat dense pockets of matter called globulets. They're fairly massive compared to maybe like hundreds of Jupiters they compare them to. So they've got some mass to them, but they're spread out of a really, really large distance, which they described as 50 times the distance between the Sun and Neptune. So I converted it to a few different ways. You could express that as 140 billion miles, which is also equal to 1500 AUs, astronomical units, which is the distance between the Sun and the Earth.
Now we're talking.
Miles. Mm-hmm. Or 8.7 light days, and that one I think is my favorite. So they're big. I mean, they're really kind of big.
900 zillion pieces of spaghetti.
So we've actually known about these globulets for a while. They're not new, but what these researchers discovered, though, is two different things. One was that they are denser. They're a lot denser than we realized. And this means that they can actually collapse under their own weight to become planets. I mean, if you've got the density, gravitational gets stronger and stronger, bam, there's a bam again. They can eventually coalesce into planets. So some of them, though, can actually become brown dwarfs, which is kind of, an intermediary object between a planet and a star. So some of them can be truly massive. So the other thing that they discovered was that within the nebula itself, these globs are moving really fast, about 80,000 kilometers per hour. And this velocity comes from the radiation pressure of the stars that are forming in the center of the nebula. So this pressure just accumulates, I guess, and just gets them going at tremendous velocity. And of course they would be ejected. So that's the bottom line right there. That's essentially it. So we now know of a new process that can not only create planets without a sun, which is key, of course, but they also, this process also accelerates them out of their birthplace. So that's the other key thing. So you couple that to the fact that there's been thousands and millions of nebulas like Rosette in the long life of the Milky Way, and you have a secondary potent source of rogue planets that are roaming the galaxy, and probably every galaxy out there, there's trillions of these rogue planets, and this is a process that creates them. Yeah.
I mean, I love those scientific findings that forced me to actually like completely change my mental image of the universe, I'm thinking that the galaxy is stars and around those stars are planets. But in fact, there's like all kinds of planets just roaming around starless in the galaxy.
It's so sad.
I like contemplating the potential for life on planets like that.
Here's something, Bob. I've never encountered any science fiction that referred to rogue planets. Right? It's just never been an element. There may be one out there. If anybody knows of one, let me know. It'd be interesting. Think about it. What a cool science fiction element that would be. You could have a secret base on a rogue planet somewhere. It's not near any star. How magnificently hidden would that be?
Yeah.
Okay, Evan. It's Who's That Noisy Time.
It is Who's That Noisy Time. Last week we had a puzzle. It was the shortest puzzle I've ever come up with. You needed to complete this sequence. Here we go. G4E5. F3. And to complete the sequence, you would have had to have guessed, well, I would have accepted a few different things. H4 or QH4. And what does the sequence represent? Well, this sequence represents the moves on a chessboard when playing chess that causes a checkmate in two moves, also known as the fool's mate.
Ah,
excellent.
And lots of chess players out there in the SGU audience. Congratulations to all of you. But there can be only one winner, as we always say. Now, do you guys remember a fellow
fight
by the
name? Fight to the death.
50 off with his head.
50 skeptics enter, one leaves. The fellow by the name of Trinok from the message boards. Perhaps you recall him. Yes. Well, he guessed correctly. His name was drawn. He is this week's winner.
He deserves it.
In any case, we have a brand new Who's That Noisy this week. This is a classic, as I like to call it, when I play for you an audio clip and you need to detect who or what or how that noisy is being made. So without further delay, I give you this week's Who's That Noisy.
A number of these cases, when they're floated through the wall of their home, through the window, through the door, again, this so many of the details of these experiences make no sense in our...
WTN@theskepticsguide.org is the email address for Who's That Noisy Guesses, or you can post it on our forums, which is sguforums.com. Good luck, everyone.
Thanks, Evan. One email this week. This one comes from Mike Cottrell from Ontario, Canada, and he writes... Recently, I was listening to one of Stephen Novella's lectures from the Great Courses regarding sugar and its effects on children. Basically, he said there's no correlation between the two. I found this surprising and happened to mention it to a registered dietitian who said the recent scientific studies have shown a link. Further, she mentions the physiology of the body implies a natural effect of simple carbohydrates on the body. She also mentioned that many studies on the subject have been funded by the sugar industry and therefore implies a conflict of interest. I would appreciate it if you could cite the studies where Professor Novella has obtained his information.
Big Sugar.
Big Sugar. So, yeah, I mean, you got to love the...
That's my wrestling name.
Yeah, it does. Big Sugar.
Nice.
I
love it.
The automatic assumption of a conspiracy of conflicts of interest. It's just a knee jerk now. You don't like that study? Oh, conflict of interest, Big Sugar, big whatever. You know, just they just assume it without any evidence. The studies are not funded by Big Sugar. It's ridiculous. These are mainly psychologists looking to see if hyperactivity is at all influenced by diet. Okay. The literature on this has not changed that much since I recorded my course on medical myths for the Great Courses, which, by the way, is on sale. The idea actually comes from a man by the name of Feingold. You guys ever hear of the Feingold diet?
No. Feingold, no. As in fine gold?
F-E-I-N-G-O-L-D.
No.
There's a senator named Feingold, but that's
all. Yeah, this was a briefly popular, you know, fad diet in the early 70s. But this was where the notion that food coloring and additives and then eventually sugar in children's food and their diet leads to hyperactivity, behavioral problems, etc. And he advised, you know, putting children on a completely additive-free diet. This is a wonderful example of confirmation bias. Just about every parent I run into has a firm belief that sugar makes kids hyperactive. And their jaw hits the ground when I tell them that it's not true. Their confirmation bias is so strong. But it has been studied. It's been studied over the last 30 years. And there are review articles reviewing this data. And essentially, whenever you do a double-blind study where you have kids in a controlled, observed situation, you establish a baseline. They either get or don't get sugar. They don't know. The people observing them don't know if they get sugar or not. There is no difference in their behavior, their hyperactivity. The phenomenon vanishes under proper blinding conditions, which means it's not real.
Most people think that's true. Still, I mean,
yeah, yeah, absolutely.
It's a pretty pervasive belief, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's the mommy instinct.
Every
reaction.
Parent I talk to, either where it comes up, and I say, you know what, it's been researched and it doesn't show any effect. They have a hard time believing it, and only people who like really know me well and understand that I know actually I'm not just talking out my ass. I actually reviewed the scientific literature. They're like, wow, really? Wow, I can't believe that, because they're so convinced by the confirmation bias. Because think about it. Kids' behavior is massively variable. There are times when they're calm. There are times when they're bouncing off the walls when you want to smack them upside the head, right? And every time they're hyperactive, you're like, gee, did you just have some sugar? The answer is probably going to be yes. You right. know why? Because kids are always eating sweets if they have access to them. So the opportunity for confirmation bias is massive. The other thing is when parents do an intervention, we're going to, you know, reduce or eliminate whatever sugar, additives, food dye from the kid's diet and see what happens. And then the kid's behavior is better. You know why? That's the Hawthorne effect. It's because you're seeing what happens. It's because you're interacting with your kid more. You're observing, you're changing the environment. So the confirmation bias works that way as well. But the research is the research. The most recent review I found was in 2006, and it's still the same. It's often referred to as a controversial hypothesis. The data has never established it, and the conclusions range from it's been shown not to be the case to, well, it's controversial. The data doesn't show that it is true, but maybe we could study it some more. That's like the most favorable review that you get.
Steve, to get back briefly to the immediate effects of sugar, what about the emailer's friend's point that sugar is a simple carbohydrate which the body breaks down quickly or whatever? I mean, carbs yeah. do give you energy. So
carbs give you energy, but first of all, some starches are broken down into glucose faster than sugar,
whoa.
Than table sugar. So sugar is actually not the most readily available source of glucose. Hmm. That's actually a common belief that is just simply not true. Sucrose is more than just glucose. It's glucose and fructose. And it's actually slower to break down than starches, which are the chains of glucose.
They should have named those really different things because yeah. I always forget which is which.
Yeah.
That's all.
But another thing is, you know, your body has a fairly elaborate system for buffering things like sugar, glucose levels, keeping it in a good functional range, not too high, not too low. Imagine if our ability to function and the amount of energy we had was dependent on what we just ate. You know, that's not a very adaptive, you know, physiology. We metabolize it, we buffer it, we store it, we release it when we need it, we store what we don't need. Our body titrates exactly how much glucose we have in our blood, in our cells, in our liver. So you could also make the argument that it doesn't make much sense that, you know, that you're going to get these, you know, highs of energy and then crashes of low energy just because of what you're eating immediately. You know, actually our bodies are able to buffer our glucose levels quite well. You know, so that it actually doesn't make sense in my opinion.
Gotcha.
All right, guys. Well, let's move on with our interview. We are here at TAM 2013, and we are joined now by Sanal Edamaruku. Sanal, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you.
Also sitting with us is John Rennie, as seen on TV.
Ooh. I have seen you on TV, yes.
That guy owes me money.
From Hacking the Planet, of course, former editor of Scientific American. So Sanal is the founder and president of the Rationalist International and the president of the Indian Rationalist Association. You were on the show before talking about your tantric killing challenge, which made you not only a celebrity in your own country of India, but really an international celebrity, especially among skeptics and rationalists. And your problems have not ceased since then. People are still trying to kill you. Tell us about that.
Well, the Tantra challenge has, in a way, helped me a lot to expand my horizon. The Indian televisions, I mean, of course, we had a presence earlier, but that has given new dimensions and a lot of new viewers started seeing our programs. And it has been going very well. I mean, I have been on television on an average some 200 times a year.
That's
for
great.
Last 4 years.
Wow.
And in most of the time, I would be meeting directly face to face with some astrologer, some tantric, some guru, some holy man. And all ended with their careers diminishing after that.
Yeah.
And this was quite a successful process which was going on. Eventually, I mean, this has given a kind of scare amongst a lot of people, and there were a lot of efforts to stop me. Mm-hmm. But because of my popularity, things were not that easy. Last year, there was a miracle in a Mumbai church. It's not, interestingly, not with the Hindu holy men, I mean, who belong to the majority community of India, who were after my life. But when I exposed this miracle in Mumbai, that turned totally different. The miracle was very simple. A statue of Jesus, a crucifix, was dropping some water from the feet. Triplets were coming. Mm-hmm. And the church claimed that Jesus is weeping. Mm-hmm. And the tears are coming down.
He's crying from his feet.
No, crying, and it's yeah, flowing through the body, and right. Dripping on the feet.
He cries a lot, Steve. A lot of tears.
So do I. Stigmata causes some problems.
Quite a lot. Quite a lot to be distributed to 1,000 people visiting every day.
Mm-hmm. And they were ingesting it, right?
Yeah, they were just drinking it. I mean, some drops were given on their palm, and they were licking and drinking it. And it was offered to them by the church. First, I have responded to the in a television program, sitting in Delhi in a television window. I said, this need not be even investigated because no statue would ever produce water. It needs some water source. So I would request the church authorities, if they have not artificially done it, they have to look around and see what it is and stop it immediately. That would be the most reasonable thing I would advise. So there was a very interesting response from them. They took our arguments and started telling that you always insist on empirical evidence. So you don't have an empirical evidence that this is not a miracle. Mm-hmm. So you should come to Mumbai and verify it. And you should prove that this is not a miracle.
Mm-hmm. So throwing the burden back on you.
Yeah. So, but that was a cleverly made trap that I understood later. Because five days later, when I reached Mumbai, first church waited for a long time to allow me to visit this place. I have gone with a crew of television people. When I reached there, 1,000 people were there making a prayer, and the priest was reading from Bible, and I waited till the prayer was over, but halfway they stopped to distribute the holy water to everybody, brought to me also. And I refused to drink it and collected some samples for chemical analysis. Mm-hmm. And after the prayer, I was allowed to watch this thing. Then the priest came and gave me a hammer immediately. And I asked, why this for? You said there could be water trapped inside. Why don't you hit it and see, break open it and see whether there is water?
Break open the statue?
Yeah. Very simply, they offer it. The idea was very simple. And if I take this hammer in my hand, if I think, okay, that's a good opportunity, and I do that thing, that moment 100 camera flashes would be recording it.
They're going to use that against you.
They would immediately claim that, I mean, he has come and damaged our statue. Right. That would be a serious crime.
Right.
I would not get any support from anywhere. Mm-hmm. So I refused to touch even the hammer. Then they said, you have some supporters with you. Why don't they dig the floor and see? I said, we don't want anything of that sort. First of all, we would like to have a primary observation about the scene. So I've verified the area, and first thing I found was the wall behind was wet.
The wall behind the statue was wet.
The statue was independently standing on a cement base, and just behind that was a wall, and it was wet, and algae was growing already on that, which means water presence for quite some days. So I went behind the wall, and again there was water and algae growing. So then I went through the algae line, and it reached a toilet straight away. And then I looked and found that the toilet water is leaking heavily through that thing. And I went back again through the line. And then I found that it's open at one place with a stone covering it. I removed the stone cover of it. And it was stinky water cloaked for so many days. And it's really, really, really stinking. And I took photographs of the whole scene, videographed the whole thing, recorded everything properly. And then I went out. And I wanted to see one more thing. Whether there is water presence above the feet of Jesus or it's from the nail only down. Hmm. So I was almost clear that capillary action is taking water up on the wall. Similarly, on the cement base, it has taken up. And the nail, there was a hole on the feet, and it was draining through the nail and dripping down through the feet.
Oh my God.
Okay. I wanted to confirm it once again, and I've gone there and touched above the feet. No, there is no water. But on the nail, it's wet. And down it is dropping. And of course I smelled. Unbearable smell.
Oh no.
I had to wash with so many times with, chemicals so that the stink goes.
Oh man.
And, I knew what was happening, and some of them understood also what I identified.
Now the other people that understood were your camera crew or people that were in
the camera crew understood. The priest accompanied me. Apparently he understood it.
Okay.
What was happening. So he suddenly asked me to explain to the crowd what I have found. Mm-hmm. That's again another trap.
Yes.
So if I talk to the crowd, somebody can simply attack me. And later it would be seen that this intolerant guy has come here and, tried to make trouble amongst the people. So a crowd has attacked and killed him. Very simple like that. That's quite possible in India. One of the best ways to eliminate a person would be agent provocateurs in a crowd, I mean, making an attack.
Yeah.
And nobody's responsible after that.
Yep.
So which would look provoking somebody's religious sentiments and, I mean, they reacted. It would look like that. I refused to make a statement.
Wise.
But they insisted, you have to speak, otherwise you would not be allowed to go. That was a very hard position. So then I thought, well, I'm a good speaker. I decided, yes, to handle the situation. I said, okay, I speak. Then I started speaking about Indian constitution, the fundamental rights of inquiry, free expression. Then I spoke about Hindu miracles, about the Sikh miracles, and their own miracles, which was refused by Vatican. So there could be natural explanations. Then I looked at the face. I mean, as a speaker, I was very successful. Half the people, I mean, the common devotee was not very fanatic.
Mm-hmm.
They were listening to me and started shaking heads.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then the priest found that it's not very good.
Uh-oh.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, okay, enough, you go.
So it was working far better than they had hoped.
So you filibustered.
Yes.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yes. But things did not end there. That was the interesting thing. I decided to, I mean, the channel wanted me to speak in the prime time at 9 o'clock about this expose. And they gave me 10 minutes to speak about this miracle. But the church insisted that it should follow a discussion where the church representatives also should be there to defend the miracle. So the channel agreed. I also agreed. What's the problem?
Yeah, why not?
I got 10 minutes. And I explained everything so properly and so well. And it worked so well. Because on an average, there were 1,000 people. Till that day, the miracle is over that night. Next day onwards, there was nobody visiting to collect this water.
Wow.
It's simply finished. They have even started constructing guest houses for pilgrims and all these kind of things. Everything collapsed. The whole money hopes the church had is all blown up completely.
Right.
So, but in the television program, the 5 people who came, that included a priest, a lawyer from the Supreme Court, from the church side, and the trustee of the church, some organization's leaders, and they all argued so hysterically. And I didn't really get time to, I mean, speak anything because 5 people shouting so hysterically. And the moments when I got time, I said that it's not a miracle and you have been claiming that it was a miracle. So they said water would not climb up. That's against God's law. Water goes down only. That's
Oh, wow.
they're very interesting arguments they have been making. But the bishop apparently understood the danger of the damage his own people were doing publicly.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So halfway, the bishop asked the channel that he would like to join the program. So it was quite impressive, the whole structure. So bishop joins halfway. So the Mumbai bishop comes and starts with a very interesting statement. So he says that you come from a very responsible organization, but I would like to say that, like anybody, you are a born ignorant person. He said, that's a very interesting statement. But I would like to say that, I mean, you have been telling all these years that we all are born sinners.
Yeah.
This argument is first, I mean, heard from you. But would you please explain what is the ignorance that I have? Miracles do happen and you do not know about that. I said, anything that is not understood is taken by some people as miracles. But on other cases, fraud states and fake cases do miracles and you take it like that.
Right.
So we do not promote miracles. He tried to be soft in the beginning. I said, but you do promote miracles. There are 2 miracles to be attributed to every saint when he or she is declared as a saint. And you have more than 10,000 saints. Means 20,000 miracles Vatican has officially attributed.
Exactly, yeah.
And on the other side, the latest history of Mother Teresa. Course anybody knows about that thing.
Yes.
Mother Teresa was declared a saint after a lady, Monica Becerra, claiming that she had tumor and she put a picture of Mother Teresa on the stomach and the tumor has vanished. But I found from the hospital records that she had a surgery before making the statement and removed it surgically. That made a big damage to them.
Yeah.
So I mentioned about this case. So he got angry. He said, do you know that we promoted science and you are speaking on behalf of science? How can you dare to do it? I said, how did you promote? So the Pontifical Science Institute has made the scientific progress in Europe. And the atheists and skeptics and free thinkers are making claim that it's against the church or against belief. It's not like that. It's the other way around. I could not stop laughing.
Yeah.
I said I would not answer that thing. But in your own terminology, I would invoke 2 people from history. One is Giordano Bruno. The second would be Galileo Galilei.
Yeah.
They would answer you.
Yeah.
So he said, do you know Galileo Galilei has at last apologized to the church?
At last?
Yeah,
like recently?
The church has not apologized to him. Galileo, of course, I mean, after 12 years of imprisonment, he has apologized for getting his freedom. That was after 12 years of rigorous persecution.
Yep.
Yeah.
I said, you have persecuted a person, and poor person at the end of it wants to have a free life. And if he cannot stand straight in a jail for 12 years and he wants to go out and stand straight, he would apologize. But I'm a person who would not apologize even in that situation.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
He said, you have to apologize, and we will see to it that you apologize for all what you said. I said, that it became very serious.
Mm-hmm.
Then he said, there are laws in this country where I know how to stop you. You will not see sunlight again.
And he's saying this on TV?
On TV live. And I say, look, this is the language of medieval times.
Yep.
And you brought dark ages at that time, and we would not allow you to bring dark ages in India. That's where the program ends.
Wow.
Bishop walks out angrily. And of course, when I wanted to go out, the channel representatives came to me and said that you are invited to the channel CEO, have a dinner with him, because there is a crowd waiting for you.
Wow.
And I was taken to the channel head's room, and I mean, we had dinner together so that the crowd disperses. And meantime, some of the channel people identified who were the people in the crowd. They were not devout Catholics, but professional beating people in the Mumbai mafia, which the church has hired to beat me.
Oh, thugs.
Wow. Yeah. Right out of the gate.
Hired goons. Thugs.
So, but I want to try to make sense of this though. In order to get the thugs there, do you think they hired them before the TV show appearance?
No. When the bishop has started the conversation, in between, apparently he has advised the priest and other people to call them. So by the time the program was over, and it took some 30 minutes to wind up the whole thing. And before I come out, the group, I mean, some 10 people, some 22, 35, 40 people were there outside waiting.
And they're all killers.
They were, I don't know, killers, but professional beaters.
Yeah.
Huh.
Professional beaters.
Yep.
In Mumbai, you can get anybody attacked by paying some money to the mafia.
We call them teamsters here.
The teamsters.
Oh my God.
They were waiting outside. And officially, they were claimed to be coming from the church because they were angry.
Yeah.
But they were not even Catholics, not even Christians. Some professional people coming from different religions.
Mm-hmm.
And I remained inside, and later at 4 o'clock in the morning, I was taken out from the back door in a different car and straight away to the airport, and I flew to Delhi. But I found that the newspapers in Mumbai are reporting about the case, and they said the church is filing cases against me.
Wow.
Times of India published a report. Then I telephoned and asked, they know that at 17 police stations, different people have filed cases against me. I asked, what case? This was television debate, and whatever I said, if they did not approve, they had full opportunity to counter it. There were 6 people, including the bishop and priest, and I'm all alone. And I mean, if they could not counter it and lost the argument in a debate, and they want to beat me and they want to put me in prison, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And of course, I mean, the discussion went completely in my favor.
Yeah.
It was very clear. They looked completely hysteric, and I was cool and laughing.
Yeah.
There's a law in Indian Penal Code.
Mm-hmm.
Penal Code was made in 1860 during the colonial times.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was a British law, which we continued later. And this law, Article 295A, says that anybody hurting anybody's religious sentiments and anybody complains, and the police officer can verify it, and if he is satisfied, the person can be arrested without an arrest warrant, and it's cognizable. And cognizable is explained further. There is no right for a bail. Means, till the investigation is over, I can be kept in prison. And also, there is another provision that I can be kept in prison for my safety. So, otherwise, fanatics would attack me. If that argument is raised, I can remain in prison for several months. So, I understood the consequence, and then I discussed with the Home Minister's office in Delhi, because Delhi has a different police. Police is a state affair in India.
Yeah.
So, I was told that there is no arrest warrant against you. If you are to be arrested, the Mumbai police has to approach the Delhi Metropolitan Magistrate and get an approval. That's a formality only. They would give it because the law agrees it.
Mm-hmm.
So only after that you can be arrested. Till that comes, you are safe here in Delhi. Don't go to Mumbai.
Okay.
So, but if it comes, though we are friends, we can't do anything. You have to be arrested and handed over to them.
Right. Yeah.
That's law.
Yep.
So I agreed and I remained in Delhi and I started appearing in television programs, spoke about the same case and the way I was handled, spoke about other gurus also, about miracle mongering of Catholic Church. I've been in some 20 television programs during this time. That meantime, my lawyer suggested that I should go for an anticipatory bail application, which means I have only one legal remedy. Before the arrest comes, I can get an anticipatory bail. Then I cannot be arrested. But if I'm arrested, it's non-bailable.
Right.
So it's a technical game.
Yeah.
So my lawyers moved the Delhi High Court straight away. And the Delhi High Court apparently was afraid to touch the issue. They said, why don't you go to Mumbai and apply there? Because legally I have to apply in Delhi because that's my place of residence.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
They simply suggested that we argued so heavily, no? Because 7 lawyers from Mumbai come from the church. And they say that there is no apprehension of arrest. And the case is in Mumbai. And I cannot prove that I am staying in Delhi. But I was staying in Delhi. I have my driving license. I have my everything in Delhi. I was staying there for 30 years. Mm-hmm. The bail application is rejected. So we decided to move to Mumbai High Court. Of course, Mumbai High Court also rejects it on a technical ground. They say that we went to the High Court first. I'm legally allowed to go to the High Court to avoid several lines of argument.
Right.
Go back to the lower court. And if the lower court rejects it, come back to us. You know what it means? It was summer vacation and the lower court is closed. Hmm. Means I cannot go there.
Right.
I have to wait for months.
Oh boy.
1.5 months. So I understood that things are not coming to my favor. The legal system is not coming to help me. It was very clear for me. Mm-hmm. Still, I decided to remain in Delhi and fight it out. Media started supporting me. That the Mumbai bishop is so angry that I cannot be touched. Mm. So he wants to get me abducted to Mumbai, mm-hmm. And get me arrested in Mumbai.
So he wanted the police to actually...
Not the police, but before the police could come, he wanted some gangsters come and take me up to Mumbai and get me arrested there. Okay. I mean, so hard structures.
Just kidnap.
Kidnap, yes. Yeah. My lawyer said that, go away from public scene and remain somewhere secret. I said, it's not possible for me. I'm not that easy face to hide because everyone knows me in the city.
Right.
I'm so popular in the city because I'm on the television every day.
Yeah.
So, but still I decided to move to one of my friend's house, move some 3-4 houses, went to the university and stayed there. I mean, all these kind of things were going on.
How long was this happening for?
1.5 months. Yeah, I remained in hiding. Now, then I had another major thing that I was planning to go to Poland for a lecture tour for 25 days. And before that, if I'm arrested, the whole plans will get upset. Mm-hmm. So I decided I would go to Europe now or somewhere outside India and go for the lecture tour and come back when this dust settles down.
Right.
But this plan was going on. Some discussions were going on. Okay, now I have to apply for a visa because my visa was over. Then I suddenly found that I didn't have any visa on my passport that moment because my US visa was expired. So British visa I had to renew. Mm. I mean, Schengen visa was over. So I need some time. American embassy said 21 days for the visa. British embassy needs 15 days. So my Finnish friends who had some connection with the government talked to them. I got the visa in something like 4 hours.
Wow.
And good. Next day morning, I flew off India. And meantime, when I was in Finland, I heard that there were efforts to locate me by other people also. And it is all discussed in the
television. It's a manhunt.
It's a manhunt.
So yes. When was this?
This was the miracle exposure was on 10th of March, 2012.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And I had to leave India by June 15th. So it's more than 1 year now. I cannot go back to India, but I remain in Finland, but not simply remaining in Finland. I'm traveling around. Mm. I've been now traveling 11 countries in last 1 year, giving something like 69 or 70 lectures.
What a story.
That's amazing.
I've been following it, but I didn't get to this level of detail until talking to you. I didn't, you know, but I remember when it first broke, I was so worried about you. I remember like, I think it was an article written by a local skeptic that was talking about the church fighting you. Yes. And it just looked really dark. I didn't think, you know, I'm glad that you escaped. You know, when I found out that you left the country, I'm like, you know, that was a good move.
Good. I mean, I think at the end, we would be laughing, not the church.
I hope so. And you are an inspiration because, you know, we all fight for the same, you know, rationalist, skeptical cause, but
nobody's hired thugs to come beat us up. Yeah. So it kind of puts things into perspective.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, Sonal, thank you so much for sitting down with us and for everything that you're doing. It's wonderful. Thanks.
Good. Yeah. Thank you for the discussion.
Thank you.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. Three regular news items this week. Ready? Item number one. Scientists have identified a blood test that can identify those at increased risk for suicide. Item number two. A recent study finds that heavy rains in Australia over 2010 to 2011 actually caused global sea levels to drop measurably. And item number three, breeders have produced a variety of chicken that lays cholesterol-free eggs. Usually I give the first slot to the person who was not here last week. So, Bob, why don't you go first?
Yeah, Bob. You do not. oh, boy. All right, let's see. Blood test, identify those at increased risk for suicide. What the hell? Heavy rains in Australia in 2010 to 11 caused global sea levels to... What? Come on. Oh, man, I call bullshit on that one. Three, let's see. Chicken that lay cholesterol-free eggs. You know, I don't know why I don't have a hell of a lot of a problem with that one. But yeah, screw it. I'm going to say the global sea levels fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
Oh, man, that one seems believable to me. That was a period where there was a huge amount of rainfall. So, yeah, and, like, there's a limited amount of water. It's got to come from somewhere. So, yeah, why not? That's good, though. It's good. Combats global warming, I guess, if it's true. So, blood test identifying the risk of suicide, that initially seems ridiculous, like in line with the blood type diet sort of stuff. But then I'm thinking, I mean, maybe you can detect serotonin levels or something like that, but it's not, I mean, it's more complicated than that, but I mean, I'm sure you could be able to detect depression, like through levels of hormones and stuff, or at least something that indicates depression. So why not something that indicates an increased risk of suicide? So that's believable. So that leaves me with the last one, which I just feel is the least believable, although it would be awesome if it's true. Cholesterol-free eggs. I don't know. I'm trying to think of how that would work, and I can't think of a method for how that seems very difficult. Making a whole chicken that's cholesterol-free. That seems weird to me. I'm going to go with that one as a fiction.
Okay, Jay.
All right. So the one about the blood test for suicide. I would imagine that if there was such a thing, that it would probably be people that just have a genetic predisposition for something that they could pick up in the blood. This one about the rain in Australia causing sea levels to drop, I think that one is science. I could see that. You know, I don't know how long it would last, but maybe temporarily it would shift the amount of rain to the other side of the planet, and then maybe it gets into the aquifers there and all that stuff. Sure, I could see that one. And the final one, breeders. Breeders.
What the hell?
I heard something very strange.
Commentary by Bob Novella.
Breeders have produced a variety of chickens that are cholesterol free. Come on. No, they didn't. What do you mean? They like Rebecca said, they genetically breed out cholesterol out of the entire chicken?
No, Jake, cholesterol-free eggs.
I know, but in order to...
Yes, but the egg comes from a chicken,
right,
Steve.
Right, Steve.
You dummy.
Steve.
Oh, boy, Steve. Yeah.
But, all right.
And we, don't know and, you where know, eggs don't, come from.
Don't make us ask the question. So, yeah, I don't see that, you know, not in a short amount of time, you know, maybe if they... Monsantoized it or whatever and went in there and, you know, but I don't think about selectively breeding the cholesterol out of chickens, not in the short term. So that one is the fake.
And Evan?
The blood test, I don't know how you would do this and identify increased risk for suicide. I guess what Rebecca said, serotonin levels, there's some sort of marker in there, obviously, they're looking at. The Australia rains, you know, we were there in late 2010, and it was just a few weeks after we had departed that those serious storms came rolling in.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And from what I recall, a swath of the country was flooded, the equivalent to the size of Texas. So if you were to take essentially that much water out of the whole zero sum of water game that is the Earth and put it in and suddenly drop it into Australia, would that be enough to measurably drop the sea levels? Probably, right? Because you can probably measure it to a pretty small degree, but there's probably a drop that was, well, measurable. So I'm thinking that one's right, which leaves us with the last one, which is the oldest question on the planet. What came first, the chicken or the cholesterol-free egg? And there may be something more to this. We're not getting the whole story. Something about the eggs. There's also some other problems with the eggs, maybe, you know, that make them inedible.
They taste like
something.
Shit.
Well, yeah. You know. Woo. So it's for me, it's between the eggs and the blood test. I'll say the chicken and the eggs. I'll go with that one.
Okay.
Sure you are.
So I guess I'll take these in order then.
Every time you do that, I always get nervous.
You all agree on the first one. Scientists have identified a blood test that can identify those at increased risk for suicide.
Mostly.
I'll think that one is science, and that one is science.
Oh. Whoop.
Yay,
but
50-50.
just barely. There is a study in which scientists did look at – there's a study of men with bipolar disorder. So it's just in men, and the population is not exactly the general population. But they did identify 9 men in the study who at the beginning had a very low risk of suicide, did not have suicidal thoughts or plans or tendencies. And later on in the study, they had a dramatic – increase in their suicidality, their suicidal ideation. And they were checking blood tests throughout the study. So they were able to say, okay, let's look at all the stuff in the blood that we can, you know, check for at the beginning when they weren't suicidal and then compare that to the blood later when they were suicidal. And they used an algorithm to look for correlations, and they found a protein made by the SAT1 gene correlated with the suicidality in these 9 men.
Wow.
So this is really more of a hypothesis generating type of study. It was small. It was, you know.
So wait, the study was originally on something else?
Yeah. Yep.
And then they noticed that these guys suddenly became suicidal.
Yeah.
What was the original study about?
They were looking for markers for, you know, in bipolar men, you know. So this is very common because if you're gathering all this data, you have a population of people that have been observed over a period of time that have blood work serially or whatever it is that you're looking at. You can ask more questions about, well, maybe this happened, maybe that happened. But then again, because you're going back and sort of retroactively asking these questions, it does weaken the results.
Yeah. Yep.
And like, who knows how many different questions you asked about that population. So then it really, as I said, it becomes a way of generating a hypothesis that needs to be confirmed by an independent set of data. You know, a prospective study just looking at that one thing. So I don't, you know, this is very preliminary. Let me just say that. All right. Let's move on to number 2. A recent study finds that heavy rains in Australia over 2010 to 2011 actually caused global sea levels to drop measurably. Bob cannot believe this one. The rest of you buy it. And this one is science.
Crap.
Yeah. I was surprised at this one too.
Back here.
Jay and I read it. What?
We read it.
Tell me about it.
We did.
I know. I believe you. I believe me when you were talking
about it. We can tell you about it because we read it.
Like, shit, these guys read it.
Well, I read it too.
You just chose to take one for the team.
You guys ever, during science or fiction, you ever realize that you read enough of the, like, you say you read 2 of them,
of course,
if you read all 3, there'd be a problem. But, like, this, as an example, I realized that I read them, and I still can't make a good enough argument for one of them, even though I knew it was science. I didn't have anything good to say about it. Like, yeah, that blood test thing, it's of course it's science.
I do that because I come away from reading the articles with, like, the big idea and none of the details. So that happens to me all the time.
So here's some of the details. Australia apparently is different than other continents in that
They're upside down,
yeah. And the water goes the wrong way. So the water does not drain immediately off the continent back into the ocean. So when there's a heavy rainfall and a lot of flooding, that water is actually sequestered from the oceans for a significant period of time. And it was enough water for a long enough period of time that it actually caused a reversal in the recent trend of steadily increasing ocean levels due to global warming. And for those 2 years, the ocean levels actually dropped.
How much?
How do we know, you might ask? Well, there's several different mechanisms. The NASA's Gravity Recovery and Climate Experiment, GRACE satellites, the Argo Global Array of 3,000 free drifting floats, and a satellite-based altimeters. So these all showed to a high degree of precision that the average sea level actually dropped during that period of time. So they're saying sea levels have been rising at about 10 millimeters per year since 2011.
Holy shit.
Yep. For 18-month period beginning in 2010, the oceans mysteriously dropped about 7 millimeters. But here's the bad news. The oceans have now resumed their rising faster than ever.
So the bottom line is we need more rain in Australia.
Can't keep that ocean down.
The bottom line is this is a fluctuation, right?
Hey,
this is a background fluctuation.
Don't swear.
On the superimposed upon the steady increasing of sea levels. And so when the peaks line up, you get this huge increase, and which is what we're having right now. And then the trough of lots of rain in Australia just temporarily obscured the background rise in sea levels, but obviously didn't alter the trend. Which means number three, breeders have produced a variety of chicken that lays cholesterol-free eggs is completely bollocks because it's impossible. You can't have cholesterol-free eggs.
Uh-huh.
They don't exist. What the study that, or the news item that I read that inspired this item was, scientists have discovered
a cholesterol-free chicken.
No, the genetic cholesterol is like it's a basic structural molecule. You can't be alive without cholesterol. But they have discovered the genetic mutation that in some South American chickens that makes their eggs blue.
Blue?
There are chickens that lay blue eggs, and they're becoming increasingly popular.
Yeah, there are different kinds of colors of eggs.
Yeah,
why?
There are green chicken eggs too.
They're purple.
Green eggs
and
ham.
Let's name all the colors that eggs are.
So, but these eggs have cholesterol. And the other thing is that the cholesterol content of eggs are more determined by what the chickens eat than their genetics. So if you want omega-3 eggs, you could just feed the chickens omega-3.
Fish.
Yeah. If you want lower cholesterol, you just free-range chickens apparently have lower cholesterol than the factory-bred.
That's pretty impressive.
Ah, that reminds me. I meant to make a free-range chicken joke during that free-range planet segment.
Would have been perfect.
Yeah.
That also reminds me. I was talking to someone recently that said, depending on what a deer eats, its flesh will taste different. Is that true?
I have no idea. Have you ever eaten venison?
Yes,
I have.
I have too, but. Well, you have, Rebecca? What?
Yeah. I grew up in South Jersey, son. We ate venison.
Oh, you had roadkill every now and then?
Yeah. Smack that mother the truck and throw it on a dinner plate.
Sweet.
No, you just cook it right on the grill of your car.
Well, it's hot enough. That's only the sun.
All right, Jay, you got a quote for us this week?
Indeed. This was set in by Florin Fenneru from Orpington, UK.
Now you're making stuff up.
I'm not. It is morally as bad not to care whether a thing is true or not, so as long as it makes you feel good, as it is not to care how you got your money as long as you have got it. Edmund Way Teal, quoted by Carl Sagan in The Demon Haunted World.
Oh, cool.
One more reminder that I'm going to be at Dragon Con Labor Day weekend, and it's in Atlanta, and you can come and hang out. And on Friday night at 10 p.m., I'm going to be doing my Quizatron show, which always has celebrity guests and a full bar for the celebrity guests.
Mm-hmm.
Not for you.
Sounds like
members.
A lot of fun. Right. We'll be missing.
The audience has to pay $5.
I'll take pictures for you.
Thank
please,
you.
Please, please do.
No problem.
All right. Well, thank you for joining me all this week.
Thank you.
Good to be affixed to you.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.